Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I have Paul Gordon with me. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Donald. Thanks for having me.
And Paul is here because the cast recording for The Gospel According to Heather is now out. This is a show that Paul wrote the book, music, and lyrics for, and it played off-Broadway last summer. The cast recording is now out and available on J Records. Congratulations, Paul. It's a very fun, interesting cast recording to listen to. I listened to it last week. So talk about where did the idea come from, first off?
You know, I was actually working on screenplays at the time. I'd written and directed an independent film, and I thought, oh, I have a movie career, which I did not have. But it was an idea for a screenplay, which was just really simple. It's just, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if, you know, a young girl in high school who just wanted a boyfriend suddenly found the inconvenience of possibly being the new Messiah? And I just thought it was a fun, funny preference, premise. And I went with it, and I wrote a screenplay that basically sat in a drawer for many years. And a couple of years ago, I was, what's my next musical? I'm always looking to find source material for my next musical, and nothing was striking me. And somehow I thought about this script, and I went back and I reread it, and I went, this is great. I feel like I can make this a musical. And then I just started to musicalize it. And I mean, really, it only took me a month or two, I think, to really come up with the first draft of it based on the old screenplay and new thoughts and new ideas that I'd put together with songs. And really, that's how the whole thing came to be.
Well, it's a really funny idea because, I mean, as we know, teenagers, whether they're boys or girls or whatever, going through high school is trying for everybody you're dealing with, trying to fit in and peer pressure, and your relationship with your parents is changing, and you're struggling with your own identity, and you're dealing with things like, oh, I've got a pimple, I've got, you know, all this stuff you're dealing with, and then suddenly poor Heather Krebs is dealing with the fact that she might be the Messiah on top of it. So it's like, of all the pressures that high school kids are dealing with, you add this whole extra layer of craziness on top of it, that she actually is now dealing with something that's out of the entire realm of possibility for her. So it kind of expands what you can do in terms of characters and plot. But give the listeners a real quick breakdown of exactly what the plot is and who the characters are that you're dealing with the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think you actually hit upon a great, very quick analogy. Like, most high school students are dealing with pimples, and Heather is dealing with, I might be the new Messiah.
Right.
And I think that juxtaposition is what interested in me because of course, it's a story about somebody not fitting in. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of stories about people not fitting in, but it's not fitting in for real life reasons that people deal with every day. And what I wanted to do was obviously expand on that and take that same idea of someone that gets bullied in the same way, but for a completely different reason. So once she starts to realize what's happening to her, she used to work at a senior center, and Agatha, who doesn't speak, who seems catatonic in the story, is the only person that she can confide in. So she keeps coming back to Agatha. And in the meantime, she meets a boy, Zach, who's a graffiti artist, who seems to be the potential boyfriend, perhaps, that she's looking for, only he comes with his own baggage in the story that she has to sort out in order for her to evolve. And then I've created really the Tucker Carlson character. Wanted to do. I'm very political in my life. And I only have a couple of political musicals that I've written. And whereas I would not call this a political musical, I really wanted to hone in on that idea of how, you know, the right is taking the word woke and being absolutely insanely stupid about it. And just in everything that they're trying to accomplish, it is just astoundingly stupid. And I wanted to shed light on that in the piece. And you know, I tried to avoid making him a caricature, but really this is the guy. This is the guy we see every day, whether it's Tucker Carlson or somebody else. This viewpoint is the exact opposite of Heather's viewpoint, which is all about love and acceptance. But she has to learn, you know, she has her own life lessons to learn through the show that we tackle. And, you know, and then inevitably it's a small group of characters that come together in support of her and in support of the idea of love, which is essentially the message of the show.
What I like about it is that Heather becomes sort of is stuck in the middle of everything because of her supernatural powers that she seems to have in terms of like bringing things back to life, and she's got the, you know, these messianic powers that she's suddenly developed. But it's also the fact that you set the show in Sharonville, Ohio, which is right in the middle of the country. So it's sort of right in the Midwest. It's right in the middle of the country. Heather herself is right in the middle of this high school. I mean, everything. And she's stuck between lots of different things. I mean, you've got, she's trapped in the middle of being no longer a child, and she's not a woman yet. And it's nice because the show kind of shows the push and pull that a lot of teenagers feel anyway. You know what I mean? It's the struggle between childhood and adulthood that Heather's going through, that she's, you know, she's feeling all these different changes happening with her maturity, but she's also struggling with the political stuff. There's religious stuff you're covering, and the adults around her and her peers. And it's all the struggles that people are going through.
It's an excellent point that you make, the fact that she is sort of, she has just been a child, and suddenly she's heading towards being an adult. You know, in our first few versions, when we had readings, Heather was 16, not 17, as she is now. And one of the young women that was reading just like educated us very quickly and said, there is a huge difference between 16 and 17. And so we just changed the year 1 year. And it sort of clarified the point that you were just making. It's the fact that she is no longer a child. She is, and she's not quite an adult. She's stuck in the middle place. She's stuck in the Midwest. She's stuck in the middle place of her age. And she's stuck in the middle of the place in terms of who she can communicate with. You know, her mom, you know, we love mom, but she's not exactly equipped to handle what Heather is dealing with. She has one teacher, Ms. Parker, that is up for the moment, but doesn't quite accept the reality of what's happening. So Heather is really making this journey on her own until the ending of the show, which, no spoilers.
Yeah, but, no spoilers. Don't give anything away.
But something happens. We'll just say.
Right. And that's one of the things, and I kind of want, that kind of brings me around to something I wanted to ask you about, which is the show presents some challenges for you as a writer, because as you said, you're dealing with a character, a lead character, and the characters who are her peers, who are teenagers, who are on, you know, burgeoning adults. And it's always tricky when you are a writer of your age or my age, when you are writing for teenagers, contemporary teenagers, to make it sound realistic, to make them sound like contemporary teenagers, and the words and lyrics coming out of their mouths have to sound like contemporary teenagers. And that is always, I always find it very tricky and always difficult, because sometimes I hear cast recordings of, you know, young adult musicals or musicals that are depicting teenagers, and some the things that are coming out of their mouths, I just cringe because they just don't sound like modern teenagers. And it's difficult to do. And I would think that's also tricky somewhat, because you're also known for your musicals that are oftentimes based on literary classics. So I wanted to talk to you about both of those things, which is writing for contemporary teenagers, but also the challenges you have had where you're writing a contemporary musical as opposed to writing a musical that's based on a literary classic, because you've written Jane Eyre, Sense and Sensibility, Emma, Daddy Long Legs, which are all period pieces. And here you're writing a much more obviously very contemporary musical set in present day. So talk about both of those things, because those are really different things for you.
Well, it's really a great point. And take your first point in terms of language and contemporary language for teenagers. Because yes, there's a big cringe factor when the oldies start to write for the youngins. And that is just a fact of life. But we do it because we're writing pieces that affect us, and we write for young people, we write for older people, we write for people that are not us, and we write for people that are us. As writers, that's our job. That's what we're tasked to do. And which doesn't mean that it's not incredibly challenging. But you know, my background, which maybe not a lot of people know, is in pop music. It's not in musical theater. In fact, my very first musical was a rock musical called Backstreet, that Katie Segal did. That's where my friendship with Katie sort of bloomed. We were friends before we did the show, but her career started from doing my show Backstreet in Pasadena way back in the day. She got her agent and her career, and she was off and running, which is one of the reasons that it was so lovely that she ended up doing the show, coming full circle, working with me again. But again, I just want to stress that I was writing pop music for years. And then Jane Eyre was a bit of an anomaly for me. It was the first time that I was tackling classic literature. And, you know, hooking up with John Caird was just amazing and sort of coincidence and how all that happened. And I found that I really loved writing adaptations of classic work, and I've done quite a bit of it. But what I've also done along the way is written quite a few contemporary musicals that have just not had the attention that, that you know, Emma and Jane Eyre and Pride and Prejudice and Daddy Long Legs have received. Heather's really my first visible musical in New York that's contemporary, but I have been writing contemporary musicals for a while, and I love writing contemporary musicals as well as classic musicals. It just really depends on the mood I'm in. I tend to write on guitar more when I'm writing my contemporary shows, and then obviously my language changes. But I have an observation that I wonder what you'll think about this, is that, you know, I work with a lot of young people when I'm doing this, and I'm very keen on language, and I'm always listening to language, being a lyricist and a librettist. And I'm always amazed they sound pretty much how we sounded. Like, they're using many of the same words we use, many of the same expressions their parents use. That's what they're using. And there are new expressions that they use, and we kind of weave them in. But what I did with Heather, I'm very collaborative writer. And, you know, when I find a cast that I love, I want to hear from them. I want to know what they think. So we had a few actors in this that I would just say, like, does this feel natural coming out of your mouth? What would you say instead? And one actor, Maya, who is playing Kaisley, the best friend, who's fabulous, you know, she would come in with different line alternatives. And I would just go, yes, say that, because that's funny and that's better than what I wrote. And and John Caird taught me this, you know, we always take the best idea in the room. There's no ego involved. You know, if a production assistant went, hey, what if you did this? Great. You know, let's do that. You can't have an ego in this business, which most people do. I certainly have an ego, but I try to keep it. I just try to keep it contained when I'm in the creative process and I'm working with other people, because I'm trying to learn as I go. And I find there's so much to learn from actors who generally a week into the rehearsal process know the material better than I do, especially on the classic literature. You know, I mean, I would have actors, wonderful actors, just say, oh, you missed this juicy bit right here. Why isn't this a song, or why isn't this a scene? And I would say, I saw that. It's about length, or I missed that. How great. Let's find a way to incorporate that. So, but yes, I do think there is a danger for writers, especially now in 2024, when we have more awareness of so many things that we didn't have awareness of literally 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I'm aware that things are changing, and that there's some pieces that maybe I shouldn't write, that maybe I might have an urge to write, but maybe I should leave that to someone else. So that's what's happening right now, I think, in the arts. I think you raise a very good point.
That's all I'm saying. 'Cause we don't care whose pointless rules we're disobeying. Why should we wait when it's our time to rebel? Why should we waste these precious days when some hell? This can't wait to drink the beer that we will later stink of. Chug, chug, chug! Why should we wait when the world is a joke? Why should we waste these precious days when we could go for broke? Don't try to starve this teenage rebellion. Maybe I'm finally blending in.
Theater is always a very collaborative effort. And I think that once you're in the room in the rehearsal process, that's when collaborations happen. And it takes a really good open director and creative team and a writing team to be open to hearing from the actors and hearing from others in the room, to be open to hearing ideas. It's their job because of the title that's by their name, to take those ideas and filter them and use them and sometimes throw things out and put things in and mold them into a final piece. And you know, some things that's will right. work and some things won't. You know, that's it. They're the ones right. who take all those ideas and distill them down into the ultimate final vision. But being open to those things. And I've been in multiple rooms during rehearsal processes where the directors and the writers will take ideas from actors or anybody, even just somebody who's in the ensemble who says, oh, did you think about blah, blah, blah? Because they can see people are like, if they've hit a wall and they can't figure out how to, you know, fix a staging piece or something, you know, a piece of blocking yeah. that's just not working. And somebody in the ensemble will say, well, what about blah, blah, blah? And it suddenly clicks and everybody goes, oh, we didn't even think of that. And it just fixes it because you're open. And if you're not, but if a director and the writing team have given off this attitude of, we don't want to hear from anybody, then you're stifling that creative process and it can ruin the entire thing. So if you're open to creativity, it's so fruitful for everybody.
Absolutely. And the word that jumped out at me that you said is the word filter. Mm-hmm. Because I think when I first started working, you know, on Broadway, you know, on Jane Eyre, I mean, that was really, I was green. You know, I had done a few shows, but not on that level. And I was pretty green in terms of how everything worked. So I would observe, and I didn't really have a filter at that point. And I think John and I were actually in a similar place. We were just sort of listening to everybody. Mm-hmm. And then I think the time we got to Broadway, we had not developed our filter enough. And the truth is that we've been working 10 years on the show to make it the show that we wanted it to be. And we had our first production of it in Tokyo last year. And we're having our first English language version of it at Raleigh Theater in North Carolina with Megan McGinnis directing this spring. So again, we are always working on the show and trying to improve it. But the other word that the filter triggers for me was also my Jane Eyre experience, where we listened to all of the critics. We just listened to everyone. And then we did exactly what they asked us to do. And that was not the best version of the show that we created. We ended up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. And it took me, that was the experience that it was like, don't listen to everybody, mm-hmm. you know, filter it. So when I started doing my next shows, it was like I'd wait till the show was done. And then I would read all the reviews and I would just see, is there a focus point that everybody is saying?
What's the common thread? It's sort of like, what's the common thread? Yeah.
Exactly. And this is true of people in the room, critics, everything. It's just there's always outliers. It's like, I don't like this, or I love this moment. It's both. But what is the common denominator? Is there one? Mm-hmm. And as writers, especially in theater, where you have the opportunity to show your work in various stages and then continue on, it's really important that you filter those voices and that ultimately you trust yourself. And which I do now, as I will hear everybody. And then ultimately, especially if I'm book, music, and lyrics, I'm going to make the final decision on the piece and what needs to be there and what doesn't need to be there. I might not be right, but I'm experienced enough now to know that I'm going to hear everything that you're saying and then make a decision based on my gut.
Mm-hmm. So in this, and now talking about Gospel According to Heather, talk about how that worked with your rehearsal process for this show. Now, you did talk about how it helped you with the teenagers and getting feedback from the performers with them. But you also have adult characters in the show who play a pretty important role in this. So I wanted to talk about the characters played by Jeremy Kushner in the show, as well as you mentioned briefly a moment ago. You talked about the mom. Character of the mother, who I one of the things I really appreciated her song in the show, because through all the chaos and craziness that's going on, she just can't help but still be a mom. It's sort of like she doesn't know what else to do except just be a mother. And that, you know, she has that one song about the sneakers, and it just kind of leaps out at you, and you feel for her so much in that moment, because she doesn't really know what else to do except be her mom, but just be the mom.
Thank you for getting that moment.
Sorry?
Thank you for getting that. I mean, did. That's so nice.
Well, and that's one of the, and again, said that. Because my listeners, I drive them crazy with this, is that when you listen to a cast recording, I tell my listeners, please dedicate the time to sit down and listen to the cast recording from beginning to end in one sit. Sit and dedicate the time to listen to it from beginning to end at one full sitting, because it's telling you it's a narrative structure. It's telling you the whole story. Everything makes sense. The characters, the plot, and everything are all right there. And you got to listen to it all at once. And when you get to her song, it makes sense. You've just finished the breaking news number, you just finished everything that's going. I mean, you just finished where things have suddenly started to explode, and the mom comes with this number, and you can tell it's not a very long song, but you can tell that she's kind of just doesn't know what to do. So she's falling back onto her mom stuff, and she doesn't know what else to say. And I thought it was very touching in a way, because you felt that she was struggling.
Thank you for that. Yes. And that is the purpose of her character, is to sort of be the one like, I have no idea, you know, there's a lot of, you know, moms and dads and people that are just like, what's happening? I don't get, I just want everything to be normal.
But what I liked about it was that it is the parental reaction that parents have to teenagers, regardless of what the teenage crisis is.
Yes.
In this, yeah. I mean, it's how parents react to teenagers because they're being teenagers. In this case, it's her reacting to a teenager who happens to possibly be the Messiah. And she's reacting the same way she would have reacted if Heather had just gotten into trouble at school because she ditched class or something. You know, it's sort of like it's her natural parental reaction to a teenage problem. This just happens to be a monumental teenage problem. But she just reacts the exact same way. She doesn't know what else to do. So that's what she does, which is why I thought it's touching, but it's also kind of funny, because she doesn't have another reaction.
Yes, exactly.
She has on sneakers. Can't she for once wear a dress? Is that too much to ask? Am I being selfish? Would it have killed her? Okay, I won't say a word. Nice pair of shoes would have been my choice. She's so in her head and perhaps too analytical. I don't understand all her views. I'm not political. Yet she thinks I'm overcritical. I should start dinner. She'll come. come home pooped and worn out. I should make her some soup. Would you like some soup? She'll be exhausted, and she's still my little girl. She just needs some rest. She needs her beauty sleep. One of these days she'll leave home, but that's years from now. She's still a child, and I still dry her tears for now. A mother interferes for now. She has on sneakers. What will that girl think of next? Could she for once wear a dress? Is that too much to ask?
All of the adults react completely differently. There's mom, who reacts just how you said. It's like, well, my daughter might be the new Messiah, but there's dirt on her sneakers. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the important thing in the moment. And then there's her teacher, Miss Parker, who knows there's something extraordinary about Heather, has always seen it, but doesn't know what it is. And then when she starts to sense what it might be, she's actually in denial that that's what it is, and actually never fully embraces that idea, but embraces the intellectual part of Heather. And then, of course, Jeremy's character is the antagonist in the story.
But he's playing, Jeremy's playing two characters, right? Now, was it designed to be played by the same actor, or was that just...
We always thought it could be. And Jeremy was the perfect actor to do it with, because his Ray, who's the street singer, the busker, and, you know, originally, I mean, that character always existed, even in the original screenplay, as I wrote him, and I just fell in love with the idea of him, and Jeremy, of course, got every beat of his humor, but, you know, he's what you would call a pivotal character in a story where he does not change. He stays the same because he's there to show us something and to teach Heather something.
Right. Well, in some ways, it felt to me, and again, I haven't seen the libretto for the show, but it almost felt like it made sense to be played by the same actor, because it almost felt like Booker and Ray are both commentators in some ways. You know, Ray is sort of like, he's the street singer commentating on things, or at least providing Heather with advice on one perspective. But Booker is also a podcaster who's commenting as a podcaster from the right side, you know, the more conservative right angle. So they're sort of almost playing a duality opposite, you know, angel on one shoulder, devil on the other shoulder type thing, in a sense. Do you know what I mean?
And that's why it worked.
If you want to know what to do, you got to take a little time, remember what you always knew. If you want to know where to go, if you want to know what to say, you got to take a little time and say it in another way. You got to try to better yourself, prepare for the weight of the world, ready or not. Time, 'cause you're such a heavenly girl. If you wanna know who to save, if you wanna know what to be, you gotta feel it inside, it's nothing you can ever see. If you wanna unearth the truth, if you wanna touch Holy Grail, gotta shine a little light upon the hallelujah trail. Yes, I'm an angel, but I'm one of three, and I am the first to guide you. So don't be afraid. There's more after this than next two are too hard to miss. Oh, if you wanna know who you are, if you wanna know what to do, you gotta take a little time, remember what you always knew. If you wanna know where to go, if you wanna know what to say, you gotta take a little time,
make a little rhyme,
let a brother lie,
let a brother lie
your way.
we're doing an interesting double in Jane Eyre in Raleigh that we've only done a couple of times, which is the character of Brocklehurst, who's the schoolmaster who's horrible to young Jane in the beginning of the show, and then St. John Rivers, the sort of ethereal minister who, you know, if you read the novel, you think, oh, marry him. But then he turns out to be not so great. But the same actor playing both of those roles is also exciting to me. I love doubling actors with parts that make sense like that.
Right. Especially because more often than not, you can't really fool the audience. A perceptive audience is going to, unless you're doing major prosthetics or something, the audience is really going to know it's the same actor. And if it makes sense, the audience actually gets it, and it helps them link the concept of the characters being, you know, similar and related.
Yeah, I think it also leans into it, the piece being theatrical.
Yes,
like, you know, I'm interested in my pieces being theatrical. I don't want my piece to look like we're trying to make a movie on stage. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the world that theater and musical theater has created. It's always thrilled me from an early age on. You know, movies are thrilling, of course, in a different way. But when you see, and I don't have to tell you this, but when you see that magical theatrical piece that uses the magic of theater, which includes an actor playing multiple parts, and you know it's the same actor, but you don't care because you're so involved in the storytelling and the magic of what we're seeing. So that always interests me as well.
Right. And that actually kind of segues nicely to the next topic that I wanted to cover, which is the other thing is that it's that your concept with this, the whole messianic concept of Heather being the new Messiah, also allows you to burst out of reality in a sense, because it then allows you to go to extremes with comedy. It allows you to go to extremes with drama. It allows you to heighten things in a show like this. So you can heighten the comedy. Yeah. You can heighten the drama. You can also make your characters more extreme. So you can make them much bigger than life. In a lot of ways. So talk about how did you apply that to the show, and did you with certain characters?
Well, that's such a great point. And, you know, I haven't been asked this question hardly at all, which I think is a really interesting question. You know, when we see fantasy comedies, you know, it's generally much bigger than life and absurdist, and the humor can be absurdist. What I like to do in those kinds of pieces is I like to keep everything as real as I can. Like, what would it actually be like if Heather really was the Messiah? Like, how would people really respond to that? What would they really say? How would a young girl of 17 really respond? You know, the premise of the show is, you know, Heather Krebs is in high school. She just wants a boyfriend, and she's being completely inconvenienced by the idea that she might be the new Messiah. I have another piece called Analog and Vinyl that we've had a few productions of that I've done with Michael Barres. And the premise is it's two people in a vinyl record store, and they have one customer, a woman that might or might not be Satan. And again, I played it as, well, what if they really thought she was Satan? Not like crazy things. I mean, it's a little crazy. The premise is crazy, but the tone of it is real. And the tone of Heather is real. The tone is there are these absurd things happening. This young girl might be the second coming. She's like healing this young boy who is near death. But in a way that, like, we're responding to it like, oh, if we actually saw that happening, how would we respond? Not how would a character in a movie respond, or how would you respond in a comedy? I find Succession to be one of the best comedies, like, ever written. I laugh harder when I'm watching Succession than almost any comedy. Because the comedy works because it's all based on a stunning reality. You know, and that's when humor is the most effective for me as an audience. And I can only write for myself as an audience. I can't listen to others while I'm writing and talking about the rehearsal process and how it evolved. Jim Kirkstead, who you know, who is just the most amazing producer. I just can't say enough about Jim's genius in how he developed this show. And of course, we did a series of table reads, and he allowed me to do the table reads the way I like to do them, which is nobody learns music, because then that's all you're doing, then that's never going to come across well. Like, let me just play the demos that I've already made that already sound nice, and let's just read the script and then play the songs, and we get it. And so we did about three or four of those. And each time we learned from the various casts that we had in the room. And just from me, it was just obvious. It's like, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, like, what was I thinking? Mm-hmm. And then when we get to the lab, like, I was, and of course, every time we go in for reading as the writer, I'm like, oh, it's perfect now. Everybody will see you don't need to change a word or a line. And then it's like, oh, yeah, that's still not working. That doesn't work. You know, back to the rewriting room. But then when we did our lab, about 6 months before we did our off-Broadway show, or maybe it was a year, I don't know. Time is all weird now. But so we did the lab that I was convinced the show was perfect. And there was a huge flaw. There was just a huge flaw that I didn't see in the reading that was so obvious. And of course, again, I got a lot of feedback. And this was, and one of, and this particular feedback was universal. And I saw it too. It was like, oh, that's not really working the way I'd hoped it would work. So all of that was a tremendous process. And of course, then our first production was off Broadway, which I still think was a great idea. But of course, like, the show still wasn't done. Like, that was our first production. It's just like, ah, I still need to fix this and this. I don't think it's radical, but I still need to fix it. And, you know, Jim, Rachel, and I, Rachel Klein, the director, you know, we're working on rewrites right now for the show because we had a fantastic opportunity to see it, get how audiences felt, you know, and I have a real sense of how to improve it and how to make it the show that, I can let this live now for a few years before I come back to it again and rewrite it. Because the amazing thing about theater that I learned coming from pop music, coming from doing film, is that it's living, as long as the authors are alive, it's living, breathing. It's like a sculpture. You can keep molding and making it different. And believe me, I love the rewrite. I am not a writer that is afraid of the rewrite. I thrive in rewriting. I'm more scared of a blank computer screen than I am, all right, you got to rewrite this. Well, all right, it's already, I know how to improve it. It's not like I've got to start over, you know?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because there are so many people out there who don't understand. They feel that once the show has had its production, and whether it's succeeded or failed or whatever, whether the reviews have been good, mixed, or bad, they just assume it's done. It's done. It's over. The writers have moved on. Everybody involved has just moved on to another project. And they don't realize that that's not really true in every case. And a lot of times,
no,
because they just assume, oh, now they're just going to put it out there for licensing and it'll be produced. And they don't realize that that's not always really the way it works. Oftentimes, like you just said, you guys are still working on rewriting and planning on rewriting the show and getting it fixed the way you want it, because it's your baby, and things, you're not happy with the way the version is right now. You want to fix it. You want to make changes. And that happens across the board. I mean, I remember a few months ago, people were shocked that there was, I read that they were doing another workshop of Almost Famous, because it had opened and closed on Broadway. And people were like shocked that they were like doing rewrites. And I'm like, well, because they were not happy with what was on Broadway, and they want to rewrite it. And they know it's going to go out for licensing. They know maybe it's going to tour, whatever, but they're not happy with the product that they put on Broadway, and they want to fix it. They want to make it better. There's nothing wrong with that. No. You know, it's got their name on it. They want to make it better. And as you said, theater is a living thing, and these projects are not. It's not like film. Although you could go back, I guess, and re-edit.
People rarely do that.
People rarely do. But in theater, you can go back and rewrite and change things and fix things. Nothing wrong with it.
And the good news, Donald, is that, you know, the licensing companies, you know, are starting to go more digital now. I work with, you know, I work with MTI, who I have a great relationship with them. But I'm also working with a newer company called Uproar Theatrical. And they are pure digital. And like their premise is, like I have two shows with them, Analog and Vinyl, which I mentioned, and a show called Being Earnest, which is the importance of being earnest set in, you know, Carnaby Street, 1960s London. And we kept every word of Wilde's book, but we wrote pop songs to it. And it's really fun. But the point is that, you know, they do everything digitally, allowing us, especially with Analog and Vinyl, which Michael Barres and I are still working on, to update it at any time. In other words, people are doing productions of the show that it exists.
Right.
But as Michael and I do these rewrites, as soon as we've got a new updated version, boom, it goes into the system, and the next show will no longer have access to that version.
Right.
Or they can if we want them to, but they'll have the new version that we feel is more the version that we're ready to show to the world right now.
Yes. It's not the old days when they would ship out boxes and boxes of printed out scripts that have been used and reused and reused and reused.
I mean, I still have some of the boxes in storage of Jane Eyre. I mean, they were beautiful to look at the time, but my God.
Right.
Like digital now, it's just like, here it is. There, it's in your Dropbox.
Well, of we're course. Done. Yeah. So talk about the cast recording, because it's always great to get something memorialized into a cast recording and putting this together. Because it's so, if you're making changes, are you making changes to any of the songs? Because now that you have the cast recording together, are you thinking of making any changes to the songs going forward?
I mean, actually, 99% of the changes is really the book.
Okay.
Because and the changes I'm making will not really affect the songs. I mean, I may go back in and do something. I might write a bridge to Sneakers and expand that a little bit. And there might be, and there will definitely be lyric updates that I would do. But, you know, the way that I write is I'm always, you know, I'm always music first. I have the lyric idea, but the music has to be, the music is crucial for me personally. Like, I won't even start writing a lyric or going there until I feel like the music is perfect for me. So, and then what I will do is keep tweaking lyrics. I will have first draft lyrics that I think are ballpark to the music that I think is absolutely right for the moment. And then I will keep tweaking lyrics. So there's still more lyrics to tweak. But mostly I think the songs will stay the same. And then the book changes to me were pretty obvious that we needed to make. And are not huge, but will make the show considerably better.
I'm just a teenage girl in a troubled world, trying to hold my place. Know you are something more, down to your very core. A genius undefined with an astounding mind. The likes I've never seen. No, I'm just a normal kid, ashamed of what I did or am about to do. There's nothing normal. I know you're your teenage girl.
What right now is the future for Gospel According to Heather? What's going on? I mean, it, obviously it's not going to be out there for licensing yet because you guys want to put changes in. Are you hoping for somewhat more productions, or are you just going to get changes ready for licensing? What do you want to do?
I can't say specifically what Jim has in mind, because first of all, Jim is such a great producer, and I don't like to go up to a producer and go, what's happening now? What's happening now? I know they have to tell me. And in fact, Jim and I just did a new project together called Ribbit that I filmed one of my musicals on the SAG microbudget. That's what I was doing for the last 2 weeks, which was a whole other thing, which was amazing. But we had talked about Heather, and you know, he said, I've got things going on. Obviously, a production is the next thing that we want so that we can make these improvements, put these changes in. And then I think we're ready for licensing or, you know, potentially whatever might happen next. But I'm so grateful that I had this opportunity to like bring the show to New York and just put it out there for a month. I think it was a very, you know, I'm very keenly aware of what's happening in our industry right now. And I have a lot to say about that, which maybe we can save for another time. But I know that it's very, very challenging to develop new work right now. And so I'm constantly looking for new ways to do that. And when I finished my draft of Heather, Jim sends, as you probably know, he sends out his Broadway bulletin with all his Tony-winning shows and all the fabulous shows he's a part of. So I just happened to get this email like the day I finished my draft of Heather. And I just wrote him back and I just went, hey, do you have any bandwidth to listen to a new show? And he wrote me back very quickly and said, what's it about? And I told him, and he went, send it to me. I got a call an hour and a half later from Jim going, I want to produce this. And he did. And I have to tell you, that has never happened to me. I've had people enthusiastic about my work saying yes, saying no, whatever, but never sending a show out that I just finished and having a Broadway producer, the caliber of Jim, come back to me and go, I want to do it. And then he did it. Mm-hmm. And he did it absolutely in the right way, doing a series of table reads, a lab, and then an off-Broadway production that was just a month. Because I think the off-Broadway mistake that people make is, you know, we sort of made it with Daddy Longlegs, is thinking you can just run forever, which you can't.
Can't.
And you know, unless you have celebrities and they're not going to be in your show forever.
Right.
So I think off-Broadway is a very different thing right now than maybe people suppose it is. And so I think as writers, you know, that are not, you know, like have a series of Broadway producers that are going to just absolutely do our next show no matter what it is, I'm not in that club. So, you know, I'm constantly thinking about how to develop new work. And Jim, I think Jim's method of development with Heather was absolutely stunningly brilliant.
Well, Jim is the kind of guy, I've known him for, I hate to say this, but decades now, but he's the kind of person who gets, when he finds a project that he's passionate about, he's the most dedicated person. He just gets so dedicated to a project and he stands behind it and just goes, he pushes right through and he follows it all the way through.
He sure does. And it makes so much sense because, you know, I'd sent him some projects before that he liked, but he was just like, yeah, no, this is not something that
I'm he's very honest. He's very, very honest about it. If there's something he just isn't feeling it, he just tells you, it's not something I can feel passionate about or I can get behind. And he just doesn't do it. And and I appreciate that because I think that that's a good, that to me, that's makes a good producer because he will be honest with you and he will tell you, I just don't, he doesn't say, and he's also smart because he doesn't say, I don't think it's a, he doesn't tell you he thinks it's bad or he thinks it's a flop. He just tells you it's something that he himself doesn't think is right for him. And that's why he's not going to do it. So
because that's what art is, right?
Yeah,
that's what we're talking
absolutely.
About. It's like Jim as a producer, as a creative producer, he knows what art is for him.
Right.
You know what it is for you and I know what it is for me. That doesn't mean the three of us are always going to connect on what on what that thing is, but that's the beauty of why we have art and why, how can you possibly like that show that I hate? How can you possibly hate that show that I love?
Right.
Well, that's the way it works.
Yep. So one final question before I let you go. When people do get a chance to finally see Gospel According to Heather, whether it's a new production that you are involved in or eventually down the road, a regional production of the show, what do you want them to take away from the show when they see it?
Well, besides that the message is love, I do go back to this James Baldwin quote that he said that I love. He's had so many brilliant quotes, but about every aspect of life, but this about art is my favorite. And I feel like this is the message of the show, which is the purpose of art is to lay bare the questions that have been hidden by the answers. And I think that is the purpose of great art. And since this piece is political and it's also about religion, I feel like it is offering that idea of, you know, sometimes the answers we're hearing are not the correct questions that were asked. And what are the right questions to ask in 2024? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the show asks those questions and speaks to, what does religion mean to you? What is it? Is it real? Is it not real? If it were real, if the new Messiah were to come back, how would we respond? And I think all of those things are interesting, but the ultimate takeaway is that what I think the universal message of religion is when it is not corrupted is love. And I know that sounds so simplistic, but, you know, I've, you know, not that I'm a religious scholar, but I've, you know, looked into religion my whole life and have been fascinated by it and have my own feelings and opinions that I felt like I was able to incorporate in this show.
Well, Paul, I'm glad you were here. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I want to make sure everybody knows that The Gospel According to Heather is now available. You can stream it on all the sites, but I will tell you, please purchase a download. That way, some money is actually being generated. Do not just stream it. Please purchase a download. And there are physical CDs on the way. There will be CDs available in a couple months, I think. So those are coming. So keep an eye out for those. But in the meantime, please purchase a digital download. It doesn't cost that much. You can afford it. Anyway, Paul, thank you again for taking the time to chat with me. And hopefully you'll be back really, really soon.
Yeah, thanks, Donald. This has been great. And you've asked such great questions. I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me.
My name is Heather Krebs, and that just felt so goddamn good. I am invincible. I put him in his place. Holy Moses, I can feel the will of heaven. Hallelujah. Could this be my day of judgment? Is this a sign of divinity? Could this be my holy trinity? Please let me lose my virginity. Too much. Sharonville, Ohio. Make bullies repent.